Talk to Me. This is a new lecture series brought to you by WNYC.org. Baseball season's here, and with it comes all of those superstitions and grudges. Like when the Brooklyn Dodgers left Brooklyn for Los Angeles more than 50 years ago, Brooklyn fans felt betrayed. The man to blame? Dodgers owner Walter O'Malley. And though history has proved O'Malley to be one of baseball's great visionaries, there are still grudges out there.
So let me just say, let's be fair about this. Let's talk about Walter as in any way you want to, but let's keep it calm. Don't light up any torches.
That's the New York Times sports writer Richard Sandomir, and he's cautioning an audience at the Brooklyn Historical Society. They're all there to discuss a new biography of O'Malley called Forever Blue. It was written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael D'Antonio. He was there also and was even joined by Walter's son and former Dodgers owner Peter O'Malley. It was a star crew, and the audience was very excited about asking them questions. I recommend staying tuned to the end. So let's get started. The first voice you'll hear belongs to the Times sports writer Richard Sandomir.
I just wanted to start off by saying I know Peter a little bit over the years in my capacity of covering sports business for the Times. He's always been gracious about talking to me when he wanted to talk to me. Sometimes he didn't want to talk to me, which is a reasonable thing when the New York Times is calling. Although we do have this very interesting telephone thing where the recipient of a call from the New York Times sees only 1111111 on the caller ID. So it's sort of like our, you know, our Klingon cloaking device. I've known Mike on and off since middle 80s when we both worked together at Newsday. We've renewed our friendship and acquaintanceship over the past year or so when he was working on his book. We talked a little bit about it. We spent some time last year at the Hall of Fame when Walter O'Malley was inducted. And on the Saturday night before the induction, there's a party for all the current Hall of Famers who were there, their families, the press, and so on. And I'm standing at the entrance of the Hall of Fame with Mike and his wife, Toni. And, you know, I'm sort of narrating the entrance of everybody coming in. And we see Tom Seaver walk in. And I know Tom a little bit, so I gesture him over. And I said, "Tom, this is Mike D'Antonio. He's writing a book about Walter O'Malley." And his eyes light up. And you got to realize, Tom is a big, strong guy. And he's a little bigger than he used to be, and, you know, in retirement as a winemaker. And his eyes light up. He's so excited. He grabs Mike by the shoulders and starts shaking him. And he says, "You're writing a book about Walter O'Malley. You're writing about Walter O'Malley. Walter O'Malley brought baseball to the West Coast. I loved Walter O'Malley." Now, I dare say that's probably not the reaction most of you people have here, which is probably the reason why you're all here. So let me just say, let's be fair about this. Let's talk about Walter as in any way you want to, but let's keep it calm. Don't light up any torches. And because as you know, Walter evokes very, very different reactions. In Los Angeles, he's a hero. In Brooklyn, he's sort of the anti-hero. And Peter tells me that he comes back every year or so. He's greeted in a friendly manner. So let's be friendly here. Mike wants to start off with a little excerpt from reading from his book about what Walter O'Malley means.
Well, actually, I think, Peter, if you want to say a word about how this came to be, that would be...
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Peter, what about
you? Thanks, Richard, and thank you, Deborah. And I do believe strongly in this institution, and anyone here who can support it, really try to do that, because the history of Brooklyn is maintained here, unlike, to my knowledge, in any other place, and I commend this institution. About 3 years ago, we got a letter from Michael D'Antonio. Michael's an East Coast, New York area person, and said he'd like to write a book about my dad. He had visited the website that we put together about 5 years ago on my dad's life that's rather large. And I wrote back, as I recall, and said, "Michael, I don't think so, but whatever, I'll be in New York and we'll have a cup of coffee." Well, we did. We had lunch. We had sushi. And we met for the first time, and he said, "Peter, I'm really not a big baseball fan. I'm an exhaustive researcher. I have a passion to do research. And your father had a very unusual, colorful life, and it's never been captured, and I'd like to take a shot at that. And I said, well, I'd like you to meet my sister. Next time you're in L.A., come on out and meet Terry. And he came out about a month or two later and visited with the family. And we agreed to cooperate with Michael to write this book about my dad's life. Cooperate's an important word. It is not an authorized biography. We had no control at all whatsoever. And it's not unauthorized. If someone wants to write a biography about you and you don't want it done, then you tell your friends don't cooperate. That is my understanding of an unauthorized biography. And this is not unauthorized. It's right in the middle because we cooperated. In addition to all the research that Michael did, libraries and not private, but papers of others who've been given to museums, he did his homework, and I think he really did capture my dad's life, and for that we're grateful. I remember, I guess over sushi that first time, Michael said, Peter, what would you think if I found out that your dad was a horse thief? And I said, well, Michael, write it, but get it straight. Get it accurate and get the facts. But if you have found out or if you find out that he was a horse thief, absolutely, that'll add some color to the book. Well, that's not in the book because he was not a horse thief. That's how it all began, and that's perhaps enough right now. Okay.
Should I use this one?
May I add, visiting WalterO'Malley.com is very illuminating. You can see a video of a short piece of acting Walter did in a series with Chuck Connors. Walter played a country doctor.
Well, it is great to be here, and Peter is correct. I'm not really a baseball guy. I love baseball, but you know, I'm not one of these people who can tell you who played every position in 1948. I got better at that as I was doing this project. But I'm really a history guy. I love finding untold stories of history, and the variety of my subjects is kind of crazy. You know, the last book I did was about the first year of the space race and Sputnik. The book before that was about Milton Hershey. And what they all have in common is that I like to find stories that people think they know about figures or events that they may have experienced or have an opinion about, and then surprise them and surprise myself by doing deeper research. Walter O'Malley qualifies for this kind of project on a number of bases. He was certainly a famous fellow. He was very innovative when it came to managing major league sports teams. He was certainly a figure that prompted emotion in wherever he went. You know, where else could you find a guy who generates so much ire and controversy in Brooklyn and so much love in Los Angeles that 30 years after he died, he's still talked about? You know, love him or not, the fact that he's still the subject of so much controversy and discussion suggests that he's worth considering. You know how you can set your computer to give you a hit every time Google records somebody's name or a subject. I get Walter O'Malley in my email every day, and that's pretty astounding. But I did face this challenge of getting to the man despite all of the previously published and previously broadcast impressions of him. The key breakthrough, I think, in the book was the O'Malley Archive. Walter, the way I peg him now, was a kind of old-fashioned guy when it came to the battles that he had in his life. If you and he came head-to-head, maybe it was an athletic contest and the damn Yankees beat the Brooklyns one more time, he wanted to win, but when it was over, he shook your hand and that was it. In fact, when Bobby Thompson hit that awful home run, he went to Ralph Branca and put his arm around him and said, really, it's a game. Come on now, it's going to be okay. and he moved on, and the next year he wanted to win again. Well, it was the same with the battle to get a stadium built in Brooklyn and his decision to leave. His nemesis here was Robert Moses. But after it was over, he and Moses corresponded positively, and Walter didn't talk about it. People would rail about him and criticize him and curse him in the newspaper, and he never went on record in a detailed way about what happened from his side of things. So he left behind what I thought was a big empty space that could be filled with enough research. And it turned out that in a suite of offices off of Wilshire Boulevard, there's about 30,000 files sitting in cabinets and boxes, and some of it's organized and some of it's not, and some of it's covered with dust, and most of it has Walter O'Malley's name on it. When I found out about this and realized that a little bit of it was being employed for the website, but there was much more to look at, I thought, this is a writer's dream. You want to get to the words that person wrote when he was alive, to the words that he read in other people's correspondence, and it also gave me leads to go around the country and connect with Johnny Padres before he died. And I went to see Buzzy Bavese, the old general manager, 6 times. And it wasn't just a matter of me saying, tell me about it. I had letters that I could talk to them about. What did you mean when you said this? Or what did O'Malley tell you about this other incident, whether it was Jackie Robinson or Robert Moses? So you can start to construct a better picture of the man through records like this. And I'll just read you, you know, I hate it when authors read from their books, but this is only 5 paragraphs. The animus and affection heaped on O'Malley long after his death raises an obvious question. How could a sportsman be so hated in one place and so beloved in another? The Brooklyn-Los Angeles divide suggests part of the answer, but parochialism does not explain it all. It's important to recall, too, that O'Malley was an imposing figure who wielded power over a popular institution and supervised many ambitious and headstrong individuals. You don't run a ball club and have everybody like you. It just doesn't happen. Few people ever enjoyed more direct authority than the owner of a ball team in the days before free agency. This power allowed him to accomplish great things, but it also aroused suspicion, envy, and animosity. Any attempt to explain O'Malley must consider the gaps in the record of his life. He was not the type to reflect aloud on his motivations or reveal his innermost thoughts. From the outside, anyone could see that O'Malley was devoted to his family and that he thoroughly enjoyed his wealth, status, and the trappings of success. Who else would organize safaris in 1960? I mean, safaris, that's for the movies, but this guy would gather a group together and go off to Africa to hunt. But while he lived, O'Malley avoided close analysis. This was especially true when it came to events surrounding his acquisition of the team and the move west. Short of having access to the man himself, the thoughts O'Malley expresses in his notes and letters, the diaries that chart his travels and contacts, and all the rest of the material in his archive make it possible to see the man more clearly than he has been seen before. The diaries were an amazing thing. From around 1930 to past 1970, he kept a daily log of where he went, who he saw, and what he did. And it was all there. You know, I don't know if there are some people who know that they're playing a role in history and just start keeping the record, but this happens more often than you would think. When I did the space book, I went to see James Van Allen. Everybody would remember the Van Allen radiation belts. Turned out he was still alive. He was 93 years old. And I asked him what he was doing the day Sputnik went up, and he turned behind him and he picked out the book for 1957, went to that day and said, oh, here's what I was doing. And to have that for Walter O'Malley was an amazing gift and resource for me. In the end, it's up to anyone who would judge O'Malley to consider the evidence and attempt to see the man in full. If, ultimately, you reach more than one conclusion, you'll have something in common with many who knew him way back when. He was not a simple person who would fit easily into a single category or a simple definition. But then, what man or woman worthy of history's consideration ever was? So that's my starting point for Walter O'Malley, and let's see what else we can talk about and learn about him.
Let me just start off with the same question for both of you, and perhaps it's best geared to an answer about Walter's decision to move the team. But Walter, Peter, you lived a life. You were part of the family. When you read the book, was there anything that surprised you about your father's actions, his motivations, and moving the team that surprised you from Michael's research?
The short answer is no. A longer answer would be, thanks to Michael, it forced us to go through a lot of his files that we hadn't done. And, wow, look at that. Gee, we didn't know that before. So during the process of the last 2 years, things did come to our attention that we didn't know. For example, the first time that he started to address the aging of Ebbetsfield was 1946. 1946, he wrote a letter to Captain Emil Prager. Captain Prager was the engineer who did Dodger Stadium, and he was the engineer who did Holman Stadium in Vero Beach, Florida in the early 50s. He was a close friend of my dad. He was a brilliant man. And in 1946, Dad writes him a letter and says, Emil, we got to do something about the aging of Ebbets Field. And that was 12 years before the move, and that was the earliest document that we found on that subject. And then for the next 10 years, I'll just add this, that I think his effort to try to find a solution to keep the team in Brooklyn, whether it was repairing Ebbets Field, which I think was beyond repair, as charming as it was, and we were all there, or to the Dome Stadium, Atlantic and Flatbush Avenue, his efforts to find a replacement and a new stadium that he wanted to build privately, not a taxpayer facility, and his dream was Atlantic and Flatbush Avenue, that effort, that extraordinary effort, did get our attention for the first time.
Michael, as it was a journey of more of discovery for you than it was for a member of the family, a lot of people here are probably well-versed in the story. What surprised you most about your research that would make you write? What surprised you most? What got to you and said, you know, this is really something that's never been told before?
Well, there are a couple of things. The first thing that I was delighted and surprised to find was who Walter's dad was. You know, if you thank God for the New York Times, put in the name O'Malley in 1920, you come up with Edwin O'Malley, not Walter O'Malley. And Edwin was the commissioner of public markets in New York City. That in itself is not remarkable, but then if you keep digging, you discover that he worked for Mayor Hyland, who was a Tammany Hall boss, a big figure in New York politics. And it was Robert Moses who went up against Hyland in 1920 to try and knock him out of office. Moses' first real foray into public life was as a young, clean-up New York City crusader for state officials in Albany. And everybody who's studied the history of New York knows that there was this political machine that ran the city forever, and every 10 years or so, there'd be a howl in Albany, and they'd send down a group of legislators, and they'd hold hearings, and by God, they're going to root out these bad guys, and they'd fail. And then, you know, the same power structure would come back, in part because it worked. You know, in those days, Tammany was considered the power structure that would stand up for the little guy. So Moses came in on this crusade against Hyland. One of the peak moments was Edwin O'Malley being hauled before this committee in City Hall, and he testifies at a table about this size against six legislators and their aides for 3 hours. And they wind up saying, "Mr. O'Malley, are you electrically wound up?" And he basically said, "I'm just getting started." So he turned this whole proceeding upside down, and by the time he was done, his supporters were carrying him out on their shoulders. And it was that beginning of Robert Moses and guys like O'Malley that surprised me. I am quite convinced that he never forgot this encounter with Edwin. And when another O'Malley came along and said, "I want to do something in the city of New York," he didn't quite get the benefit of the doubt. And then further, in 1956, 18 months before the decision was made to move the team, Walter had already spent 10 years writing back and forth. He would invite Moses to a meeting. He'd say, "Come to the ballpark, let's see a game." Moses would manipulate him and eventually turn him down. And at one point, I find this memo that says, this is Moses writing to his staff, "It is necessary to show that our opposition is based on something other than prejudice." Well, he's saying that because it was based on almost nothing but prejudice. But he wanted the public to think, "I'm going to give the shot to O'Malley. I'm going to consider this stadium." If you wanted something built in New York and Moses didn't want it built, it didn't get built. So it became clear to me that the previous researchers who had seen some of this evidence were correct, that there was more of a stream to follow. And O'Malley's effort to try and build in Brooklyn was complete, and I don't think anybody could have done more.
Which raises the question, which I'm sure a lot of you people here have, and we'll open the questions in a second, is that those who criticize Mike's biography, those who criticize Michael Shapiro for a book about the Brooklyn Dodgers, say that the focus on Moses as the villain is revisionist history, as if revisionist history is not necessarily legitimate history. So let me open it up now. You can ask questions about Moses versus O'Malley. Ask anything you want. But I think the Moses O'Malley battle is very important.
Yeah, I have several questions and comments. Did Major League Baseball really encourage this? Three of the best baseball towns in the country, Boston, St. Louis, and Philadelphia, have lost their teams in the previous 10 years. In addition, the success of the Milwaukee Braves, did that go into finally driving the nail into the coffin? The Braves moved from Boston to Milwaukee and drew double the people that the Dodgers drew in Brooklyn. Also, would the league have sanctioned a move if the Giants weren't going to the West Coast?
Well, I have a lot I can say about all those things. I think it is true that the Braves' success in Milwaukee did inspire the Lords of Baseball, as they were called back then, to consider growing baseball, to get it beyond the East Coast, Midwest centers where it was located until the Dodgers eventually moved west. So yes, I think the Milwaukee experience was considered by a lot of people as they looked at this. And the book does cover a lot of that. In fact, I think Perini, who moved the team from Boston to Milwaukee, was at Holman Stadium the day that he made this decision. And what's amazing about the Braves moving is this guy moved them all of a sudden. It was during right before spring training opened, and there was a little bit of an outcry in Boston, but not much. And that sort of taught me that what Brooklyn felt for the Dodgers was really a powerful thing. You know, this attachment to this team was way deeper than the attachment that anybody in Boston had for the Braves. So I do think that there was a connection there. I think baseball had been considering, and there's documents in that I cite in the book, moving to the West Coast as early as the 1940, 1941. World War II interrupted the consideration of that idea. But after the war was over, the people in Los Angeles who really wanted a ball club, they started pushing again. And there's a great character in the book named Vincent X. Flaherty, was one of those fedora-wearing 1940s and 50s reporters, and he pushed so hard to get O'Malley out west that he considered that he brought the team. He thought he was responsible. The last question that I think the last part of your question is about bringing San Francisco's, the Giants to San Francisco at the same time that the Dodgers went to LA. And there's no doubt that Major League Baseball, the National League, wanted two teams out there. Jet airplanes made it possible to go west without too much of a strain on a team, but they certainly preferred to have two clubs. You know, if you can go out and play in LA and then play in San Francisco, you might even return to LA again before you head back east. It made sense financially, it made sense for the teams and for the players.
Peter, did your father talk much about, I know you were just a stripling at the time. Did your father talk much about the need for, even after the fact, the need for Hearthstone to bring the Giants along?
Not really, but I think it's been documented that Horace Stoneham wanted to move the Giants to Minneapolis, where they had their AAA farm team. And whenever the light went on and they both said, well, why don't we both go to California, forget about Minneapolis, that's probably what happened at some point. But on the move, at part of your question, what's fascinated me is that when he announces the move in the fall of 57, and we're going to play in Los Angeles in the spring of 58, he doesn't have a place to play. And as thorough as he was and as wise as he was, his options were the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, and they really didn't want a Major League Baseball team there in that neighborhood, Coliseum, which was not designed for baseball either, and the little minor league field, Wrigley Field, which was smaller than Ebbets Field. And just imagine that, and also imagine the other owners saying, well, sure, Walter, you can play next spring in Los Angeles, no problem. Where are you going to play? And he gets there, and he has to then negotiate with Pasadena, Wrigley Field he owned, and the Coliseum Commission. And when the Rose Bowl passes and they drop out, all the leverage, the Coliseum had the leverage, and that's obviously where we played until Dodger Stadium opened in 1962. But that has surprised me to this day, that he didn't have a place to play when he announced that he was going to move there. I think he got frustrated, just to add that. I think at some point along the line, maybe in the mid-50s, late-50s, he said, I'm not going to be able to do this in Brooklyn. And frustration is a key word, I think. He just said, I can't make it go here. I've got to look at other options.
This gentleman over here in the second row.
Yeah. Peter, thank you for coming. I respect you very much. Because any person who stand up for his day the way you are deserves absolute respect and affection and whatever. And Mr. D'Antonio, I didn't bring any tomatoes. So
you must be Jeff.
Right. However, I want to focus on the Moses O'Malley thing. From my understanding of New York State law, the eminent domain laws of New York State would have prevented Bob Moses from condemning the property owned by the Pennsylvania Railroad Company at the time for a privately owned ballpark. That's number one. Even if he and O'Malley were bosom buddies, and although I read from some people that while Moses was all powerful, he could have done anything he wanted, I respectfully say just do a Google search on rat and goose A to see what happens when you try to deal with questions of eminent domain.
Can I suggest we take your questions one at a time, and the first
sure.
one on eminent domain. Do you want to start that, or do you want me to do that?
Yeah, this issue of could Moses have helped, could he actually have done something? First of all, the property that was connected with the railroad wasn't the only property around Atlantic and Flatbush that O'Malley wanted. He really wanted where the old public meat market was, which is Fort Greene. And my reading doesn't suggest that it was impossible for Moses to do this. There were court cases that had already been settled that said that a commercial enterprise could be part of a larger redevelopment scheme. So he might not have been able to say, I'm going to clear out this area that the railroad controls and give it to you, Walter, but he could have helped O'Malley piece together the purchase of the property that was used by the public market and surrounding buildings, and which included some residences and a lot of commercial properties, so that he could pay for it himself. O'Malley was going to pay for this, and he was going to pay for construction of the stadium. Moses had used his power to help other commercial enterprises in Manhattan and in the borough of Brooklyn. So, and the same power was being used around the country to help commercially related projects. So if it was put in the context of redeveloping a whole area, it was possible and it was being done elsewhere in New York City. In fact, Moses had already picked a developer to come in and build apartments there, commercially operated apartments. So I would argue that if, I think that there was a way for him to use eminent domain, and the scheme that followed during the last ditch attempt to get the Dodgers a stadium in Brooklyn involved a special sports authority that would have had legal standing to use their money to develop a stadium there. Moses basically strangled it in the cradle, and that's a horrible, I hate that expression, but they got this group together. It was headed by three leading New York people, including an attorney named Mylod, but Moses worked very hard with the mayor to deny them any funding. So they had a commission that was supposed to study the development of a stadium and residential property and commercial property, and it had no budget. They were supposed to do studies. They didn't have an office. It was clear that Moses was going to kill this one way or another. So, you know, I understand that Moses stood behind that idea that I can't use my power, but he used it elsewhere in the same way.
Well, the only thing I'd add to that is public purpose is a key word. And the burden was on, as I recall and understand, my dad to show that there was some public purpose in getting assistance to assembly the property to build the stadium, and whether it was parking year-round or whatever else. I think my dad truly believed he could demonstrate that there was a public purpose in the project.
Did you have one last question to ask?
And it goes back to the thing with Moses. Moses was criticized because he felt that the proper location for the Brooklyn franchise was closer to where much of the fan base was flushing out. And he did want Mr. O'Malley there to work with him to try to develop a lease for this municipal stadium, a lease which was later given to the Mets and which has allowed the Mets to flourish. It's considered one of the sweetheart leases in the history of baseball, to such a degree that in the latest ranking of Forbes magazine, the Mets franchise is worth much more than the Los Angeles franchise. To say that Moses was totally 100% wrong and the villain in this, I think, is not there.
Well, you know, I don't say that Moses was 100% wrong and the villain, and I don't say that Walter wasn't the guy who moved the team. He was the guy that moved the team. And one of the things Peter doesn't like about the book is the title, Forever Blue. You know, Forever Blue means Dodger blue, but it also means there are people in Brooklyn who will forever be blue. But I think that if you consider that Moses identified Flushing Meadows for a stadium in 1935, that long before anybody tried to talk to him about keeping the team in Brooklyn, he was going to build the stadium in Flushing Meadows, and he never was going to build it in Brooklyn. That's an important thing to consider if you wanted to keep them the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I don't know that O'Malley was wrong to say, I want to build my own stadium and own it. Most of the stadiums that were built in 1960 forward were these circular, they called them hat boxes, that were not really charming, good places to watch a game. There were multi-purpose facilities owned by some municipality. Usually it went way over budget. Candlestick Park in San Francisco is what Stoneham got, and it was atrocious. So I think, you know, this guy wanted to give Brooklyn a private stadium. Imagine today when we're subsidizing with billions of dollars worth of bonds these two new ballparks. If we were looking forward to a spring training at the equivalent of Dodger Stadium sitting in Brooklyn, and that we didn't owe any tax money on it. It was privately held, and the neighborhood around it had been developed. You know, the Mets worked out great, and they were going to work out great. But I don't think that you can say that it was the only attractive offer O'Malley had.
One thing I would add briefly, and I know for a fact, my dad had no interest in a taxpayer-designed, maintained stadium. Vero Beach is a perfect example. We went there. It was a Navy Air Barracks situation. We bought the property, rebuilt Dodger Town, and it's a jewel to this day. He wanted to own, design, maintain, landscape the stadium as he eventually did in Los Angeles. He had no interest in a taxpayer facility in Flushing.
I also want to reiterate that the whole idea of it being the Brooklyn Dodgers was really important to Walter. And what I thought was really great about him is he comes in and he says, I want characters on my team. I want a whole bunch of varieties of guys who are tough, who are scrappy. He liked the connection with the emotional feeling of Brooklyn. You know, Brooklyn, I think, is a tough blue-collar, mixed place where people are real with each other, and he liked that whole identity of the team. And I think the idea of them being, if they're going to be the Queens Dodgers, they could be the L.A. Dodgers just as well. I think that was his choice, but that's how it worked out.
Gentleman over here.
Presco Thompson wrote a book shortly after the Dodgers moved. And Walter O'Malley, I think, wrote a whole lot about the Dodgers.
You know, I don't think I did see it. It might have been out of print so long that I never got a hold of it.
If you ever have a chance, you'll see the passion you gave to Brooklyn. Couldn't support a newspaper. The neighborhoods were going to hell in a handbasket. He was so gratuitous with his destruction. I mean, it was totally unnecessary. And nevertheless, we went around and put the prologue in my good friend, Fresco Thompson.
Oh, so Fresco said all this about, yes. About Brooke. Well, and you know what's interesting is people.
I was talking about the grit. And by the way, you know something? The Brooklyn people would have said, okay. We'll go to Queens to watch the Dodgers if we have to. It shouldn't be either or. You're looking at two titanic egos duking it out at our expense. And if Walter O'Malley couldn't get his way, it was the highway, just like Robert Moses.
Well, but how long was the guy supposed to try?
Well, the first program has been trying 25 years.
Well, I and it. Yeah, and he got it.
And Minneapolis would have the same thing. And how many other places? You know, it wasn't that long. And by the way, when you say a stadium built in 1913 was dilapidated by 1944, you're looking at 25 Wrigley Field, you got Fenway Park.
Well, 1913 to 1957 is 43 years.
43 years.
Right. And you know, I talked to the people who ran Ebbets Field. And the only way that it stayed open was that one of them was related to the fire marshal. So, you know, I saw all of the bills that were paid to repair bathrooms that couldn't get repaired. You know, it was a great place. I talked to Don Newcomb about this. He loved... there were a lot of subjects raised, you know. Did Horace Stoneham try to stay at the Polo Grounds? No. Nobody knew Horace Stoneham was thinking of leaving until the spring before he left. He creeped out to meet with the guys in San Francisco and said, okay, I'm going. I think the reason people got mad at O'Malley is that everybody knew for 10 years that this battle was going on. If he hadn't been so public about it and said, I want to stay, oh, I can't stay, I think people wouldn't have been as upset about it. And what city lets go of two premier franchises in 1 year? Today, you know, you tell somebody that a ball club's going to leave, they do everything they can to keep them. The people in L.A. said to me, we didn't take the Dodgers, they were given to us. And we couldn't believe our luck. Now, the bottom line is, O'Malley made the decision, and I agree with you about that.
Well, where he essentially says, It's a matter of
time. But Peter, your father did not voice everything that went on. Obviously, he had to be secretive about certain things. But, you know, was he, would you agree that he was playing one city against the other?
I would say not until the ninth inning, starting in the late 40s, as I said before, in the 50s. Our family, including my dad, had no interest in moving to California or any other place. I was born in Brooklyn. I went to school in Brooklyn. We lived in Brooklyn. We had friends in Brooklyn, and a lot of them are kind enough to be here today. At some point, as I said a minute ago, I think he just reached the point and realized he couldn't do it in Brooklyn, and then he looked elsewhere. Whether that was in 56 or 57, I don't know. But I know for a long time he broke his fanny to try to do it in Brooklyn.
The other thing that I was surprised of, I thought O'Malley was powerful too. You know, I did, and I do agree that this was two tough guys fighting it out, and the people who probably lost the most were the people in Brooklyn. There's no doubt about it. Not probably, they did lose. But Moses was so far and away more powerful than O'Malley ever was. You know, Moses had already spent 30 years on a publicity machine where he had 1,000 articles a year published about how great he was. He held at one point a dozen different jobs in the city. And it wasn't until Rockefeller came along as governor that anyone ever stood up to him. So when I read these letters that go back and forth between the guys, O'Malley's a pipsqueak compared to Moses. I mean, he was powerful compared with the average guy. But I didn't see it as two titans in the end. I saw it as, you know, this was, you know, Joe Louis against a good amateur boxer.
From each of your perspectives, it's interesting to hear talk about the dilapidation of Ebbets Field versus how long Wrigley and Fenway have lasted. Was Ebbets Field just not built as well? Was it not taken care of as well? Because we see how Fenway and Wrigley, they're not going anywhere. The Red Sox keep adding to Fenway. They have those seats above the Green Monster. What was it about Ebbets from your point of view and yours that gave you a sense that why was it deteriorating so much?
It probably wasn't as maintained as well as Wrigley Field, and I've been there a long time, and Fenway Park. But it probably was neglected because of cost to properly maintain it, and that would be my short answer.
Well, what's really great about this archive that I explored was that it had records going all the way back to 1890. And all the way through, especially the 30s and 40s, when the Ebbets and McKeever families owned the team, they bickered like crazy, and nobody wanted to spend money. So you had this fractured ownership group, and every year they basically put a coat of paint on the place. They would have engineering reports saying this concrete is crumbling, this plumbing has to be ripped out and completely replaced, and they wouldn't do it. You know, they did buy 30,000 gallons of paint a year, which was very impressive to me. But compared with what they did for Fenway Park, which is the stadium I grew up with, Fenway Park was kind of a dump in the 50s and 60s before they realized what they had. But it was much better maintained. And it's not. We should also consider that there are only two of those old parks still around. It's hard to keep a building that's exposed to the elements in that kind of condition that's used by a million people a year.
I have a two-part question. One, what part did the politicians in those years play? You know, where they had some powerful politicians, you know, especially the Brooklyn politicians. And the second part is, what about the commission? What was this part?
Well, the question was, what did the Brooklyn politicians do about this, and what did the commissioner of baseball do about this? When people ask me why the...
Also include in that answer to that question was the national politicians. I think the comment, you know, Manny Seller and Representative Hillis, what part that they played, which not only involved Brooklyn but the potential of moving the team to LA. I think that's, you know, relevant.
Well, there are a lot of things that happen politically. You know what really I think cost Brooklyn the Dodgers? 1898, Brooklyn becomes part of New York City. If Brooklyn had been a separate city, as it had been up until then, Brooklyn would have had a mayor. Brooklyn would have had a city council, and Brooklyn would have had its own director of urban development. And I don't think you would have lost the team. You know, I think everybody would have been invested in keeping the team. When New York City wrangled with all these issues, there was a lot of clash between the representatives of the different boroughs about who should get the stadium. When the Mayor Wagner wanted to help the Dodgers, the city aldermen and councilmen from Queens rose up against it. They could never get organized in Albany to do something together. So I was really surprised by how weak the Brooklyn politicians were. The borough president really doesn't have any power to do much. So it was interesting because I had to study a lot of Brooklyn history, and I could see, boy, they thought they were doing the right thing when they joined New York City, but they gave away so much. And when it happened, people were warning about that. They were saying, do we want to lose our autonomy? On the commissioner's level, I didn't see a lot of evidence that the commissioner's office was invested in Brooklyn Stadium troubles, and that's the same today. The commissioner of baseball or the commissioner of the National or American Leagues don't have much of a role to play in whether a city keeps a team, whether a city builds a stadium, although the owners do have to vote on the switch in franchise locations. And Walter and Horace Stoneham got the owner's approval pretty handily. But there wasn't a big role for the commissioner to play. On a national level, there were, and this is really interesting, there was a whole move in Congress to bear down on the monopoly in Major League Baseball. There were players agitating about their contracts, and they'd get their congressman and put their arm around him, and they're a baseball player. They're probably the hero of the congressman when he was a boy, and they would say, well, we don't like this monopoly hold that they have on the game. So there were lots of pressures in Washington, actually, to open up the game, including getting it out to Los Angeles. There was a very powerful congressman named Hillings who played an influential role in pushing baseball to move west. So there is all this politics beneath the surface, and also what you wind up reading about in the newspaper, that's real and very hard to go up against if it's moving against you.
Plus the agitation of the league that was formed by Branch Rickey, the Continental Baseball League, that created the atmosphere to bring the Mets into New York. Let's go towards the back row, all the way in the back.
Thank you, Paul Parsons. I'm sorry, I didn't hear your opening statements.
Thank you, Paul Parsons. Speak a little bit louder.
Three parts, I don't know if you addressed that in here before. Race, black, and brown. So class, New York Yankees versus the Bums, and TV contracts. Why couldn't they resolve this, which were to negotiate TV contracts, which supersede back in the stadium?
Well, I guess I could take up all of those. You know, I think the class issue, boy, I know that there was this idea that the Yankees were the team for guys who took showers in the morning, and the Dodgers were the team for guys who took showers at night. And I think that that's really true. And it may have been that the powers that be at City Hall and in Albany didn't have much sympathy for the people in Brooklyn. There's a great quote. You know, I hate to give Moses the credit, but the guy could write. Here's a paragraph from Moses giving a speech at the time the Dodgers left. If only a fraction of the genuine enthusiasm which the Dodgers aroused could be channeled into the building of a new Brooklyn, what a town it would be. When the Dodgers are on top, it's the morning's morning in Flatbush, and all Brooklyn believes that God is in his heaven and all's right with the world. When the Dodgers are down, there's no joy in Gowanus, no balm in Gravesend, and the shades are drawn on the old Canarsie farm. What a people! Happy or blue, their disposition depends on the standing of a team.
As if they were a different species.
Right, right, right. So there definitely was a class element here. And as far as race is concerned, and I'm glad you brought up Jackie Robinson, and I didn't know this, but Rachel Robinson told me that everybody who really knew him called him Jack. And I have a hard time saying Jack, because I just remember Jackie Robinson. Walter O'Malley, in some people's telling, didn't get along with Jackie Robinson. Could have been a racial thing, could have been something else. A lot of people would say these kind of whispered things. The truth was that 2 years before Robinson came, O'Malley went on a secret mission to Cuba to look for a black ball player. When Branch Rickey brought up the idea of let's integrate baseball, let's go against the league, which had just issued a paper saying we shouldn't do this, the country's not ready for it, O'Malley said, I'm with you. So they brought Jack Robinson in and a bunch of other ball players, and O'Malley was 100% behind it. Where the tension or the falling out happened with Jackie Robinson was when Branch Rickey left. And Rickey was a hero to Jackie Robinson, and he was a genuine hero for America, for bringing black players into baseball. I think that anyone who would have bought Rickey's stock and been the man in charge after Rickey left would have had trouble communicating with Jackie Robinson. It was just that big loss, and Rachel explained it to me that way. There were some missteps that Walter made. Walter did one thing that I would never have done. He had a conflict with Jackie, and he said, bring your wife in with you. You don't do that to a ball player. You don't do that to any man and say, come on in. When the encounter happened, and Rachel remembered this, I think Walter immediately understood what he had done wrong and apologized, and that was it. And then finally, I'm looking through documents, and it's a big dusty file I open. It's around 6 o'clock, and the fellow who's sitting at the desk in the archive is waiting to go home, and I come across this letter that's handwritten from a hotel in Jackie Robinson's hand. No one's seen this letter before. And it starts out, Dear My O'Malley. And it goes on to talk about, why aren't we getting along? My wife tells me we should be getting along. And that began a long correspondence between the two men, including Walter finally saying, why don't you stop saying there's something wrong? There's nothing wrong. It's okay. So, you know, there was, I think, this idea of Brooklyn is the blue collar team, it's the ethnic team, you know, they didn't have, the borough didn't have the kind of cachet and power that the Yankees would have had. The team I don't understand getting away is the Giants in a way. You know, they had Manhattan. How they couldn't keep them, I don't know.
I was at the Spiel in 1946, so I was 8 years old. I saw it not long ago. I thought it was the most beautiful place in the world. The strongest sculpture I ever seen, you know. And I continued to go, you know, up until 55. I went into the Navy the week after a Orange Grove series. But anyway, you know, my poem is about the Moses O'Malley deal. I don't think you ever want to, and nobody's ever going to find out whose fault it is that they were there, okay? But the one thing I do blame not Walter O'Malley for is taking the name Dodgers out of Brooklyn, okay? When Washington moved to Minnesota, they left the Senators in D.C. Why didn't O'Malley leave the Dodgers in Brooklyn?
The question was, why didn't O'Malley leave the name Dodgers in Brooklyn in 58? I don't know the answer to that, and maybe Michael does, but isn't it true that 9 out of 10 teams that have moved have taken the names with them? Los Angeles Lakers came from Minneapolis because it was the city of lakes. It was the Minneapolis Lakers. Now it's the Los Angeles Lakers. The New York Giants, San Francisco Giants.
It's New Orleans Jazz, Utah Jazz.
Baltimore Colts.
I just think the names have followed, but I honestly don't know.
Yeah, but for the Lakers, and for the Dodgers were named short for the trolley Dodgers.
Right.
Okay? So the Trolley Dodgers, that's how they got their name. They were named after fans.
I think that's a...
Giants you can name, Braves you can name. They had Braves all over it, named after Native Americans or anything like that, right? And I say, what is with L.A.? Aren't they a creative place?
The questions have got to be short.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I do think the Dodgers name does make you think of Trolley Dodgers, and it makes you think of Brooklyn. I loved it that they were called the Bridegrooms at one point. When a whole bunch of them were getting married before they became the Dodgers, they were called the Bridegrooms. And before that, they were the Superbas. But the Trolley Dodger name is a wonderful name. I'm not sure that he might have thought, well, the team is worth a lot, the name is worth a lot. The other thing is to remember that the Dodgers had the first national radio network. They were America's team before anybody heard of the Dallas Cowboys. And it may have been that as much as you love the Dodgers and everybody embraced the Dodgers here, people all over the country did too. They didn't know that it meant Trolley Dodgers. They just knew it meant Jackie Robinson, Duke Snyder, Johnny Padres, all these great players. And maybe they didn't know that it would hurt so much for them to take the name.
And after a while, I think the derivation of a team name becomes lost to history. We don't have that much time left, so why don't we go to over here.
What story is we still hear that one of the reasons both the Giants and the Dodgers were anxious to leave is because of the changing racial composition in the areas where the Bulldogs were, and the owners and their attendance was going down, and the owners felt that the perception was these are not safe areas, so we have to move. One other issue on that, in Gollumbach spoke about the Dodgers, he says Walter Riley at one point talked this told Red Smith that it wasn't Ray Tricky who was responsible for Jackie Robinson's MVP. He didn't go ahead any further.
Well, let me pick up on that. The comment was that my dad told Red Smith or somebody that Branch Rickey didn't sign Jackie Robinson, that he did. That's absolutely wrong. At no point in my dad's life, and I've never heard that before anywhere, Mr. Rickey deserves all the credit for signing Jackie Robinson. Yes, it is true that my dad and Rickey each own, I think, 25% of the ball club. Rickey was the general manager. Dad was the vice president. But Dad has never, nor has anyone in our family, ever commented. Branch Rickey deserves that credit.
Peter, one of the other questions raised is an interesting one. Obviously, there isn't a stone here to talk about it, but if he'd gotten the stadium in Brooklyn, with the changing demographics of Brooklyn, how would he have dealt with that if most of his fans were moving out?
Do you know why he wanted the Atlantic and Flatbush site? Do you know why he was obsessed with it? Every subway in the city of New York and Brooklyn and Queens crosses at Atlantic and Flatbush Avenue. Every subway. Also, the Long Island Railroad comes right in there from Nassau, Suffolk County. It was an extraordinary location. And I don't know Mr. Bruce Ratner, but I've read about his plans to do a basketball arena there. I got to believe that's the same reason that all the subways still cross at Atlantic and Flatbush Avenue, and the Long Island Railroad still comes to that location.
Yeah, on the issue of race and the location, I came across documentation that was direct about Stoneham being worried about Harlem and the Polo Grounds. That definitely did happen. In Brooklyn, I didn't find any evidence of any of it being essentially racial. But I think there was a concern that people couldn't afford to come to the games, that a lot of the middle-class base, people, guys who could afford season tickets or could come to a lot of games, a lot of them were moving out. And this idea of putting it near the Long Island Railroad was to bring them back. And also the parking thing was a mess. So if they could have had a parking garage there, that would have helped too.
Okay, we have room for two more questions. Gentleman in front.
Yes. My question is going back to the issue with Robert Moses and your dad, that in planning for any major development in the city of New York, it's always a series of compromises. And basically, two sides holding very firm to what they wanted. And once the issue of signing the stadium was settled late in the game, and Robert Moses says, I'll offer you what's currently the Shea Stadium site, my question is, why wouldn't that conversation continue where your dad could say, okay, I'm willing to compromise on the location. I want it to be in Brooklyn, but I'll accept this location. It's in the center of my catchment area in terms of fans. Long Island fans could drive there and park there very easily. Long Island Railroad stops there, the subway stops there. Why wouldn't the conversation continue to the point where your dad could then begin to try and get more of what he wanted in terms of ownership, revenues, whatever was still on the table from his point of view? It seems like that conversation on compromise ended prematurely. Could have gone on a lot longer.
It may have been able to go on longer, but as I said before, I think at some point, I'm sorry to repeat myself, I think my dad said, I can't make it go here. And if you say instead of trying for 8 or 10 years, he should have tried for 12 or 13 years, you're entitled to that view. I think he had had it. Number two, as I said before, he had no interest in a taxpayer municipal stadium. He wanted to design it, landscape it, maintain it, and run it and operate it, restrooms and everything else. He had no interest in being a tenant in a public facility.
But again, I guess it's going back to, you know, compromise, that everybody has to compromise to come to any large development.
Okay.
Gentleman
over here.
Jumping ahead to the present, the Dodgers have now left their training facility in Vero Beach, which was almost a Brooklyn-built facility, to Glendale, Arizona.
Yeah, I was down there the other day, and the question was, how do I feel about the Dodgers leaving Vero Beach after 50 years, because we had an extraordinary relationship down there. I would not have made that move, and I said that to Vero Beach, and I've said that to L.A., that if I was the president and owner of the ball club, I would not have moved or left Vero Beach. I would have found another way to find revenues. It's a business decision that the McCourts have made. They have a taxpayer facility in Arizona, $100 million facility. They share it with the Chicago White Sox. Beautiful new stadium. They'll draw 10 or 15,000 people a game. Vero Beach can't generate those dollars. And I said before, and I'll say it again today, that if I was in charge, I'd have found another way to identify those revenues, and we would have continued to train there.
Well, I think we've exhausted these gentlemen long enough. It's been a wonderful conversation. I wish we could go on for 3 hours. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Peter.
And that's it. Talk to Me is a lecture series brought to you by WNYC.org. I'm your podcast presenter, Andrea Salenzi, and I work with Otis Hart to bring you this series. Now you're at bat. Come on over to WNYC.org and leave us a comment telling us about your baseball grudges.